State and Federal Affairs Order, August 2nd, 2005, a little after 11. Committee member, audience, we've got two people missing. Representative Barker's in the hospital, and Representative Boquist's daughter is en route to the hospital, having rolled a car. We don't know what the situation is there. We have asked the good Representative McPherson to give us some courtesy votes. Probably reluctantly on some of them he will as we move through this process. So we're going to run through these as soon as we can, and not exactly in the order. I want to make sure that Senator Betsy Johnson can get on her way here in a minute. So we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 680.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 680A comes to you from Senator Johnson. It directs the Oregon Department of Aviation to establish a pilot program to up to three rural airports to encourage development through defense operations. It defines what through defense operations are. It directs the pilot projects to use public-private partnership to extend practicable. That's the bill. And it has a fiscal impact, but it's not that significant.
Okay. Senator Johnson. You would not believe, Senator, how many calls I've got in the last couple hours.
On this bill?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee. What a tee-up. For an old airport guy like me, it has been very gratifying the amount of attention that this session of the legislature has lavished on airports. I hope that this bill is one that will meet favorably with the committee. It is a very simple bill. It is a voluntary program that would include three Oregon airports, specifying Aurora State in the bill, and two others that would voluntarily come forward. It would allow private development, private entrepreneurial activity on property inside the airport boundaries that is not owned by the airport sponsor. And we create a mechanism for businesses that would build on privately owned dirt to come literally through the fence to use the publicly owned asset of the runway. There is a lot of misconception about this bill that somehow this is the all airports all the time. They could expand into any EFU anywhere. That is absolutely not the case. This is a very narrow bill. Aurora State Airport, which I managed for 5 years, is a unique situation where the state owns the principal asset, that's the runway, and almost all the land inside the airport boundary is owned by private interests. Those private interests are desirous of having an opportunity to build businesses, create jobs, attract private capital on that private dirt and have access to the airport. This is really a jobs bill. I think it will probably be subscribed to. The other two airports that will subscribe to it are probably going to be rural eastern Oregon airports, where great tracts of land sit next to airports without development opportunity because the municipality or the public entity that owns the airport has neither the skill, the time, nor the capital to make investments. I would close by saying Scappoose Airport, which is my home airport, has a through-the-fence policy. As a result of that through the fence policy, Oregon Aero, the fifth fastest growing company in Oregon, will be breaking ground this construction season on a $15 million capital investment, creating 100 jobs. And so I believe this is good policy for the state of Oregon. Contrary to rumors that are circulating through the building, it's very narrow in its scope. This will not despoil farmland. This will bring jobs and opportunity and continue to place Oregon's airports as part of an integral aspect of a fully integrated transportation system. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Committee members?
Well, I guess, Mr. Chair, just to point me around within the bill, Senator, the airports that are affected, where would I find that in the text of the bill?
I see. I regrettably don't have the bill with, but I can tell you it is a voluntary program. Aurora, thank you. Aurora is specified in the bill, the Aurora State Airport. A unique situation where the state owns almost no dirt at the airport but owns the principal assets of the airport, which are the taxiway and the runway. And the other two are, as of yet, unnamed, and they would come forward voluntarily. So there is no proscription with the exception of Aurora.
And further question, Mr. Chair, and I think you mentioned a potential for additional airports beyond these
two. Two others that would be voluntary. That's it. It's a three-airport bill.
Not more than that. That the two are included, and so
yes,
it is a
three,
total of three.
Three airports.
Okay. Now, I have no more questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I'm comfortable with the Reader's Digest version and not the hour-long testimony.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative Flores, I wasn't
Senator here. Johnson, I was just quipping that I'm comfortable with the Reader's Digest version, not
Thank
the
you.
Hour-long testimony.
Thank you.
Senator Johnson, can you remain with us a few minutes?
I can, sir. I have my own committee starting at 11:30, but I will linger as long as possible.
I have Representative Crummell come up, and you would need to testify, and if there's any conflict between you, I want to watch the fight.
Seldom are there any conflicts between myself and Senator Johnson.
I take him
Johnson.
Two falls out of three.
Game on.
That's where I place my bets.
She had an excellent wrestling coach in college. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, State Representative Jerry Crummell, House District 26, which is Wilsonville, Sherwood, and over to Gaston. My primary interest in this bill is representing my constituents in Wilsonville. And the issues around the Aurora Airport. I have no concern with the rest of the bill and through the fence operations and what it means and that sort of thing. And I also have no problem with trying to help rural airports that may be trying to bring businesses in to make both the airport and the area more viable. But I guess I would ask why we have specified in this the Aurora Airport. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the Aurora Airport is one of Oregon's busiest small airports with more private airplane registrations than any other airport in Oregon. It's very busy with a large number of private plane takeoffs and landings on a per-day basis and a number of student pilots that are learning to fly. And I guess if a student pilot is supposed to learn where there's a lot of traffic, then that's a pretty good place to learn. I think a pilot program on the Aurora Airport, to me, is kind of a wasted stimulus on an already growing area. The airport is only 2 miles from the metropolitan urban growth boundary, and this area is was recently considered by Metro for expansion, but was rejected for a number of good public policy and planning reasons after a lot of public participation. It's also one of the most controversial areas considered for expansion of Metro's UGB. There have been conflicts with the Aurora Airport and its residential neighbors, particularly that sit in my district in the Charbonneau area, over noise and traffic and airport expansion issues, but these groups are learning to work peacefully together, and I would not want to see that deterred by having Aurora specifically specified in this bill. Also, the Aurora Airport is surrounded by Class 1 and 2 soils and is some of the best farmland in the Willamette Valley and is home to many of Oregon's most productive nursery businesses and should be preserved for agricultural purposes and not developed for industrial growth. I think that this bill potentially will fuel land speculation and development pressure on prime Willamette Valley farmland, a result that Oregon has struggled with for over 30 years. I would suggest that all three pilot programs be available to truly rural airports where communities all over Oregon can compete on an equal footing basis for this economic development opportunity. And I would suggest to you that the Aurora Airport provision just be deleted out of the bill and that then on line 9 on page 2 that it would just read not more than three additional or that not more than three rural airports that volunteer to participate and then continue on with the language. That's my suggestion, Mr. Chair, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any members have any questions?
I'd like to get a response maybe from Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative McPherson, I'd be happy to respond. I think I'm uniquely qualified to discuss some of the issues raised by Mr. Crummell, Representative Crummell. I managed the Aurora Airport for 5 years and helped broker some of the peace that now exists between the Charbonneau community as well as the city of Aurora and the airport. Contrary to a mythology that's circulating about this bill, this is not a bill that would expand the airport into prime farmland. This bill attempts to make available for private entrepreneurial development land inside the airport boundaries. Aurora is a very unique management problem for the state of Oregon. The state owns the runway and the taxiway system and virtually no other land. The airport is made up of private parcels of land, some of which are under active development right now, creating jobs. They are not, contrary to the mythology about this bill, all flying jobs. One of them happens to be a woman-owned business, and she is unique in the industry given that she does body and repairs, skin repairs, for a number of what are called box haulers, their package carrier airlines. Those don't generate a huge amount of flying activity. The plane comes in and is static in the hangar while it's being repaired, reskinned, for weeks, if not months. And so this is not an invitation to the creation of a lot of necessarily flying jobs. It is the invitation to the creation of manufacturing jobs. The bill specifies that the uses have to be airport-related. And so this is really an attempt to fully realize the potential of the airport in these limited number of instances in attracting private entrepreneurial capital, rather than waiting for the state of Oregon, for example, to attract and build businesses on the property owned by the state. Heretofore, the state's record has not been good in terms of developing jobs. They're building hangars at the airport, and what we're hopeful will occur at the Aurora State Airport, which is arguably a busy airport, but we're hoping that it will attract jobs commensurate with activity at the airport, not necessarily hangars and activity of flying. We're interested in seeing our airports be realized to encourage those airport-related activities that create job stimulus. Oregon Aero makes liners for helmets that are used by our fighting men and women in Iraq. They make ergonomic seats for our military fleet all across the spectrum of military aircraft. That doesn't mean F-15s are flying in and out of Scappoose. It means that the jobs and the aviation-related company that create those products are at the airport, but they don't attract B-52s and F-15s into Scappoose.
Well, if I could, but Representative Crummell was urging that Aurora not be pre-designated by the bill as one of the three, and I guess the question is it sounds like, based on your experience, Senator, with the Aurora Airport, do you believe that should be one of the three in the pilot program?
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, I believe it should, given the unique management problems at Aurora. It has been a problem for the state, regardless of who the manager of that airport is, and we think that designating Aurora as the most complex state airport in this bill will give the opportunity for planned, orderly, systematic growth at the airport, where groups of the entrepreneurs that are particularly trying to cluster different support manufacturing businesses for aircraft manufacture or avionics could work collaboratively to develop clusters of companies there instead of really struggling to have an orderly development at that airport, which is a complex, busy airport.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Crummell, do you have any...
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. The only thing that I would add is that the Aurora Airport is growing as we speak. There are hangars that have been built, particularly on the south end of the taxiway and the runway. There are other businesses that are moving into some of the older hangars that are on the north end of the airport, particularly just south of Columbia Helicopters. Columbia Helicopters does have a very large operation at the north end of the airport. I would argue that Aurora Airport is growing. It's doing well from a standpoint of attracting businesses in there. It does have the runway size that allows for private jet as well as other aircraft to be able to get in and out. So I think that that to pre-designate Aurora in the bill is not necessary, and that you know, from my perspective, I would rather see some of the other airports that if there's another airport in the state that would be knocked out because Aurora is pre-designated, I would rather other airports be given that opportunity, other communities be given that opportunity. An example, my hometown over in Walla Walla, their airport is actually growing again, and it's because of the wine industry. There are 27 wineries located on the airport grounds, so they're right next to the terminal and that sort of thing, and that has really led to a lot of growth at that particular small airport that used to have a fighter wing and doesn't anymore. Used to have commercial service, and it does get the Dash 8s from Horizon Air flying in, and that's all. But there used to be the larger planes flying in and out of there. So they're sort of making a comeback.
Do they fly in and taste wine and fly out?
Well, hopefully the pilots aren't the ones tasting the wine, or at least they're spending the night after they do. But my point is that there, I think there are other airports around the state that would do well with this type of bill, and that pre-designating the Aurora Airport is really unnecessary.
Anything further? You can't carry it, and you won't carry it.
That's a problem, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move Senate Bill 680 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Flores has moved Senate Bill 680 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any objections? Okay, to call the roll.
Representative Barker, excused. Representative Fulquist?
Excused.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Chair Cleavers?
Aye. Senate Bill 680 moves the floor of the bill pass, and Representative McPherson, would you please carry? Close the session. Open a work session on Senate Bill 998. Chair?
Senate Bill 998B increases the weight limitation from 8,000 pounds to 10,000 pounds for the purposes of vehicle registration, definition of Class 2 all-terrain vehicles, and requirement that vehicles remain in the right-hand lane. It also stipulates that vehicles weighing in excess of 10,000 pounds that are not truck tractors may not exceed 55 miles per hour on state highways. I have had handed out to you Dash B3 amendments. These are amendments that resolve conflicts with a bill that was passed previously. It was signed by the governor, Senate Bill 445. That bill eliminated the weight restriction on Class 2 all-terrain vehicles, and since Senate Bill 998B had an increased limit from 8,000 to 10,000, the section dealing with Class 2 all-terrain vehicles in Senate Bill 998B is eliminated by the Dash B3 amendments. They're a little longer than it looks for that, but that's because Section 9 is rewritten to reflect the changes by deletion of Section 1. Also handed out, I believe, paperclip to those amendments are a fact sheet from Larry Campbell, who's available to answer any questions, I believe, if the committee has questions.
Okay, Mr. Campbell, would you come up from that, please?
Could I ask two other folks to join me, Mr. Fuller and his special witness?
Hey, there they are. Yes, that's fine.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Larry Campbell. Just a couple of quick things, because I have passed out a fact sheet that came from the task force. Task force put this bill together, and the task force was made up of ODOT representatives, all of the people who are identified below as supporting it, including the state police also were involved in that task force. The bill itself passed out of the Senate 28-1. And in essence, it's required because of the larger size pickup trucks, Hummers, and things of that kind that are being built today that exceed the 8,000 pounds present limit. And so what we're here to do is try to make a number of Oregonians legal that presently are driving the state with illegal licenses. We're most willing to answer any questions, but before we do, we have a special witness that we would like to have speak for us.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Cassie Fuller. I'm 8 years old, and this fall I will be a third grader at Clear Lake Elementary in Kaiser. Today I'm here as the founder and president of the SOLB Club. SOB is an acronym for Sisters with Older Brothers. Thank you for hearing this bill. My older brother Daniel testified on the Senate Bill 998 in the Senate Transportation Committee on April 4th. When my dad said the session was moving slowly, he sure wasn't kidding. I'm finally getting my turn to testify, and I'm in the middle of my summer vacation. Anyway, older brothers have lots of problems. The older they get, the bigger their problems become. Older brothers love to play with trucks. When older brothers are young, like my brother Daniel, they play with small toy trucks. When they get a little older, they start playing with even bigger trucks. Eventually, older brothers grow up on the outside, but on the inside, they're still little boys. They still like playing with trucks. When they are older, their trucks are much bigger and much heavier. That's why I need your help. Right now, some older brothers with big trucks can get a ticket from a policeman just because their big trucks don't have the right kind of license plate. Senate Bill 998 will let big brothers drive bigger trucks without getting a ticket for being too heavy. If you pass this important bill, I won't have to worry about Daniel as he gets older and starts liking bigger trucks. Thank you for your help.
Thank you.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, for the record, Darrell Fuller with the Oregon Auto Dealers Association. I will just parrot Mr. Campbell's testimony that this bill simply corrects a problem that we have right now where any vehicle over 8,000 pounds has to have a truck plate on it, and anybody with a Suburban that goes to Costco is violating the law when they go home because they're over 8,000 pounds.
Mr. Chairman, I'd also like to add that the Farm Bureau is represented in the audience and would be willing to testify if necessary. They have joined us in this bill.
It would appear the lobby thinks committee members that we're moving too slowly. We could hold it over. Prove your point for you.
Mr. Chairman, it was held for several months on the other side.
I would hate to disappoint Cassie Fuller.
I would too.
May I direct a comment to her?
Sure.
Thank you, Ms. Fuller, for bringing your testimony. And I want to tell you, I have some of those big older brothers in my district who are very concerned about those big trucks. So thank you for helping move this bill forward.
I have a question, Mr. Chair. More serious, and I won't direct this to Cassie, whose testimony was very enjoyable to hear. I'll direct this to Mr. Campbell. This is a fairly serious revenue impact here, $1.2 million in the current biennium and $1.8 in the following biennium. What are those revenues used for now? Who are we taking in the next 4 years?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McPherson, those are trust fund dollars. ODOT has looked at this, and this weight has not changed since 1974. And in essence, with the increase in size of trucks, they recognize, as we do, that the law presently doesn't cover the truck business as it should. And so ODOT has agreed with us that this is an appropriate loss of revenue for this purpose.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And is there anyone from ODOT here to appear on the bill?
Yes.
Yeah, I'd like to hear from directly from ODOT about the revenue issue here.
Good afternoon, Good morning, still, Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson. My name is Robin Freeman. I'm with the Department of Transportation. The revenue will come from our highway fund, which I suppose is a trust fund of sorts, but highway fund. We are neutral on this bill. We were part of the group that brought this forward as an advisory to that group. We have not taken a position, but we are in agreement that this is a federal standard, and we realize that this is something that there is a lot of interest in, and so we're fine with this.
If I could just clarification, you said it's a federal standard. I don't understand that.
Excuse me. Chair Krieger, Representative McPherson, the 10,000 weight limit that we're setting here, we're going from 8,000 to 10,000, is a federal standard that most states have already adopted.
Okay. Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, I would move the dash three amendments to Senate Bill 998B.
Representative Flores has moved the B3 amendments into Senate Bill 998B. Any objections? Therein.
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 998B to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Representative Flores has moved Senate Bill 998B as amended to the floor with a due pass. Any discussion, objections? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barker, excused. Representative Boquist, excused. Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Aye. Senate Bill 998B moves to the floor as amended with a due pass, and Representative Flores will carry. Close the work session. Open the work session of Senate Bill 557.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 557B requires, in consultation with the State Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, otherwise known as DOGAMI, the Office of Emergency Management, to develop tsunami warning information and evacuation plans to establish uniform tsunami warning signals only if money is available to do so. It also states that the Office of Emergency Management shall develop rules that for the program and the evacuation plans by March 1, 2006. And that too is in consultation with OGAMI. It does not require them to do any of this unless they have the funding. Attached to your staff measure summary, there is a fiscal impact. The fiscal impact clearly comments that the Office of Emergency Management estimates that there is, to do all of this would be an approximately $400,000 expense, but they are anticipating federal funds. So there is no general fund money attached to this, and it's clear in the bill that for them to do any of these duties assigned in Senate Bill 557 is as available funds become available to them.
Is there anybody here from Emergency Management? Come up for a minute, please. We don't want to have an in-depth discussion of the bill, but mainly any concerns that you have or the opportunity for the committee members to ask you any questions, please.
Appreciate it. Chair Krieger, member of the committee. For the record, my name is Ken Murphy. I'm the Director of Emergency Management for the State of Oregon. We've been working on a lot of these things for many years. Some things gain more attention based on world events. Again, as was read, there is a cost associated, and we're hoping that the federal tsunami legislation that's currently going through the congressional process will provide us the monies mainly to deal with signage and public education and public outreach and hopefully eventually some sort of uniform warning system. But a lot of this, especially as far as working with coastal communities and counties, you know, to develop procedures, you know, to have unified warning system, and to also try and collaborate with as many public and private agencies as possible to provide more education to the members and visitors and citizens of the Oregon coast. I'll answer any questions you may have.
Any members have any questions? They're reading at great pace.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would only comment that while there is, as the administrator mentioned, the fiscal attached, that the office is not required to carry out duties unless the funds are available,
right.
And that's sufficient, and it seems that there is the distinct possibility that those federal funds would be forthcoming. Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 557 to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Flores has moved Senate Bill 557 to the floor with a due pass. and we have to rescind the referral to Budget, Ways and Means.
And, Mr. Chair, I've modified my motion to rescind the referral to Ways and Means.
Okay, so heard. Any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barker, excused. Representative Bolquist, excused. Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Aye. Senate Bill 557 moves to the floor with a due pass. I'm going to have Representative Boone, who is a coastal person, carry it, please. Please inform her and get her the information that she needs. Close the work session. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 232. Session, Mr. O'Leary, if you could tell us a little bit about the bill, please.
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, thank you. Senate Bill 232A comes to you from the Oregon Law Commission, and this is the bill that would create the Juvenile Psychiatric Security Review Board for disposition of youths who successfully assert the insanity defense in juvenile court delinquency proceedings. It also establishes a procedure by which youth accused of offenses in juvenile delinquency court may assert responsible, except for insanity, the parallel to adult court procedures, guilty except for insanity. It is structured as an affirmative defense. That is, the youth would have the burden of proving by preponderance of the evidence, not to a jury because it's in juvenile court, but only to the judge, that the youth is suffering from a mental disease or defect that precluded the youth from having substantial capacity to either appreciate the nature or quality of the act or to conform their conduct to the requirements of law. That is the exact same standard as is the case for guilty except for insanity in adult court. The next piece, if the court makes the determination that the youth has carried its burden for purposes of the affirmative defense, the next piece is the disposition. What is the court to do with the child who has been determined responsible except for insanity because of the mental disease or defect? And the dispositional piece of this bill requires the court to make a determination about whether or not the youth suffers from a serious mental condition or from a non-serious mental condition and presents a danger, a substantial danger, I should say, to self or others. And if the court can make either of those findings, then the court must place the child in the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board, the juvenile panel that is created by this bill. The period of time for commitment is the maximum period available. That is the statutory indeterminate sentence that would be available 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, etc., except in cases of murder or aggravated murder in which the period of jurisdiction is life. I would note, though, that those sorts of offenses, by virtue of the statutes enabling Measure 11, are virtually never treated in juvenile court anymore. If the court cannot make those findings as to the serious mental condition or the non-serious mental condition of substantial danger, then the court has the option of either placing the child in the custody of the Department of Human Services under a dependency petition, or discharging the youth altogether. And let's see, there is a Dash 7 amendment that is in your packet. And the Dash 7 amendment essentially does three things. First, there is a piece that was requested by the Department of Human Services that would exclude children with developmental disabilities from being able to assert the defense, that it excludes mental retardation, developmental disability from the definition of mental disease or defect. The amendment also requires the Department of Human Services to study how a child with developmental disabilities might assert the affirmative defense of insanity and to report those findings to the 2007 legislature. Then the amendment does two other things, and these are conflict issues. One is a conflict resolution with Senate Bill 1059, which clarifies that youths in adult court who are found guilty except for insanity are not to be placed in the state hospital, but are to be placed in intensive secure community. This is the Fawn Home location. And this just makes it consistent with that, so it is clear that children are not to be placed in the state hospital. They're to be placed in this intensive community treatment facility. And if they somehow get out of the escape, that is, from the facility, that DHS is authorized to arrest them and return them. And then the other conflict is with Senate Bill 39, which is the bill that requires the court to state on the record the mental disease or defect that the person suffers from, or excuse me, that the person relied upon for the defense of GEI. And this just mirrors that requirement for the court making a finding that a youth is responsible except for insanity. The court is going to have to say on the record, this is the mental disease or defect on which the youth has relied. And that was a request in adult court where Senate Bill 39 is set from PSRB, so that PSRB had a record of what the mental disease or defect was. And as a policy matter, it seemed to make sense to have a mirroring requirement here in juvenile court. A big footnote on this entire measure does not take effect until January 2007.
Representative McPherson, your mind is moving.
Just a couple of
I should quick. Say, I'm sorry, I should say too that Wendy Johnson from the Oregon Law Commission and Tim Travis from the Judicial Department are here. The Dash A7 amendment has not been subject to any public testimony, and I know that they do have a few comments because they would like to make a record about some of the issues that the A7 presents.
Why don't we have them come up first?
I would like
the questions, Mr. Travis, and then Wendy, please. Before we start, as soon as we get this bill done, we'll recess until 1 o'clock. And 157 is coming off the agenda, so you can see what's left.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Wendy Johnson, Deputy Director of the Oregon Law Commission. I am providing you with two handouts that are the Law Commission's written testimony for this bill. I just wanted to provide just a couple of points to keep a record for this bill for the future. The Law Commission has worked on this project for 4 years. This is our second shot at sessions on this measure. So it's been vetted a long time. was composed of a work group of defense attorneys, district attorneys, judges, and the Department of Human Services and other DOJ and other people. It was a well-vetted project for 4 years, and so we've studied how many kids would be affected for a long time. So I just want to point out that this is a product of a lot of work. You have an amendment before you that has not been reviewed by the Oregon Law Commission, so the Law Commission can't take a position on the amendment. But I do want to note that when the Law Commission recommended this bill, it was to start immediately. Juveniles have a right to an insanity defense. They've had that constitutional right from the beginning, but there's never been a disposition that's been outlined in the juvenile code. And so the Law Commission took it upon itself to work on how to make that work, to have an insanity defense for juveniles. And the solution was to come up with a juvenile PSRB model that follows the adult model, and so that's what you have before you. So it's been disappointing that this bill won't start now until January 1st, 2007. So I make that point. But with the new amendments that you have before you, another concession has been made. Developmentally disabled, mentally retarded children are being taken out of this bill. And so I just want to point out that the Law Commission doesn't have a position, but those kids were included at the beginning. They have the right. And so taking them out leaves them without a disposition. So they have the right, but we don't know where they will be placed. The handouts you have before you, I just want to point to page 2 of the one that's a long ways, just sort of list why we did this bill. There are a number of reasons. First is they have a constitutional right. The second, the code is silent. The third is their community safety concerns. Where do these kids go? We want to make sure that there's the right supervision. And fourth, if they go to a NOAA type facility or treated as other juveniles who are not insane, they're not getting the right treatment, and we know that mental health is important. So those are the main four reasons of why this bill is important. You have the commission's report that explains every section. That's the other handout. And on the second page, actually, in the history section, it tells you who participated in this project. With that, I just would take any questions you have.
Timothy Travis, the Oregon Judicial Department. Senate Bill 232 is a very good bill. We absolutely need it. It needs to pass. It doesn't anymore shine quite as much light for the court as it shone before. As Ms. Johnson said, the MRDD kids have been removed, so the court is still going to be in the dark about disposition for those kids and still going to have to do the catch-as-catch-can kind of thing that they've been doing. MRDD kids have a right to a guilty but insane defense no matter what Senate Bill 232 says. Federal Constitution gives it to them. They have that right. And as Ms. Johnson said, what's complicated now is the disposition. But it's been complicated all along. So it's not like taking them out made their situation necessarily worse. It just doesn't fix the problem for the court for that category of kids. We fixed the problem for the court and everybody for one category of kids. This other category of kids, we haven't fixed it. It is sort of misleading, the language on page 4 of the dash 7s, section 39. Actually, I'm looking at the dash 6s, so maybe that's not right. Yes, it is section 39, that the Department of Human Services shall study the issue of how to allow a child with developmental disabilities to assert the affirmative defense of mental disease or defect. I'm sort of wondering why a social service agency is studying how a group of people should be asserting legal defenses, but that's what it says, so that's what it says. I'd be curious to have the Department of Human Services report to the legislature on what they do with these kids once they get them. That would be the interesting question that I would have answered. But that's not in the amendment, and I'm not asking anybody to make any amendments. This is a good bill that should pass. It's just incomplete at this point.
Mr. Chair, do we have somebody from the DHS here? I wonder if we could get them up here to kind of thrash this out a bit. First question, if I could, is the set over that occurred on the Senate side till January 1, 2007, is that related at all to this issue about how we treat children with developmental disabilities? And I guess I could invite you a response from any of you who has any knowledge about that.
Mr. Chairman, James Tate from the Department of Human Services for the Senior and Disability Program. I think the primary driver, and you can correct me if I'm wrong on the set over, was the fiscal impact and trying to minimize the fiscal impact for this biennium. I think the issue of kids with developmental disabilities, however, was a factor in that as well.
Okay. And what is the focus going to be of the study? Is there disagreement about how we ought to be relating the insanity defense to developmental disabilities? Is that something that we're going to know more about?
Mr. Chairman and Representative McPherson, the statement that was made that the department's not really in a position to study whether or not kids can use the affirmative defense, I think is correct. We didn't draft the amendment. I think the issue for us is there are additional potential legal and fiscal issues for kids with developmental disabilities. First has to do with federal Medicaid law and how that's being applied for kids with disabilities, and under all the Medicaid fund sources we have used, it appears that the federal government in most states is saying you cannot use federal match when you are incarcerating children or adults and putting them in closed custody. If it's primarily a public safety issue, then federal match does not apply. So for us, potentially, in developing closed custody, and we don't do this in the Department of Human Services in long-term care for kids with disabilities or adults, we provide no closed custody, meaning locked facilities, if, in fact, the public safety issue for that child requires that type of setting. So in moving in this direction, which we think we would have to have some level of closed custody capacity, we don't think we can get federal match, but we think we need to study that issue more. We did settle with the U.S. Department of Justice many years ago that we would not incarcerate children with developmental disabilities in a particular state facility, and I think that's an issue we'd want to look at again, and we wouldn't want to poke that bear once again because we settled a long-standing consent decree with the federal government on that. So it's not the policy issue. I think the policy issue that the Oregon Law Commission and everybody else is trying to address is a good one overall, but for kids with disabilities, for long-term care, now to get into closed custody and incarcerating children is a very big step, and quite frankly, the fiscal issues, I think, are significant that we need more time to really review.
Okay. I think that answers my concerns.
Mayor Flores? Any questions?
No, sir. Mr. Chair, I would move the -7 amendments to Senate Bill 232A.
Representative Flores has moved the -7 amendments into Senate Bill 232A. Any objections? Amendments are in.
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 232A to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Representative Flores has moved Senate Bill 232A as amended to the floor with a due pass. Any further discussion? Objections? On the roll, please.
Representative Barker, excused. Yes. Representative Bolquist, excused. Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Judge Meeker?
Aye. Senate Bill 232, as amended, moves the floor to do pass. And Representative McPherson, would you please carry? And we'll be recessed till 1 o'clock. Committee on State and Federal Affairs, a little after 1 p.m. We're going to drop down to Senate Bill 1098 and open a work session. We put the amendment in yesterday. Do you want to just review the basics of the bill before we move in?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a bill that restructures the special public works fund statutes, clarifying them, updating them. A couple of substantive things, adding two legislators to the Oregon Economic and Community Development Commission, and adding the splitting up kinds of projects so that they're simplified and not they don't have so many project categories. Mr. Chair, the dash two amendments were adopted by the committee yesterday. They prohibit the Port of Portland from developing the former Alcoa property for multimodal transportation facility until the year 2012.
Don't want any problems. If I have to carry, then carry. That's fine.
And a motion on the bill. We have the amendments in.
Mr. Chair, I move SB 1098 to the floor with a due pass.
As amended.
Whereas Boquist has moved Senate Bill 1098 as amended to the floor with a due pass. Any objections, discussion?
Mr. Chair, since you have the votes here, I think that what I would plan to do is to sort of register concern about this type of amendment with a no vote.
Okay. Anything further? Call the roll, please.
Representative Blaster excused. Representative Boquist?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
No.
Aye. Senate Bill 1098, as amended, moves the floor with a due pass. Have Representative Boquist be the carrier. Close the session. We're going to go back up to we'll go down and do the sine die thing first. Open work session on HCR 18. Chair members of the committee, this is much awaited. Adjourned sine die, regular session of the Oregon 73rd Legislative Assembly. No amendments, chair members of the committee. Representative McPherson spending the bill.
I just have a technical question, which procedurally, this is a House concurrent resolution. Does that mean it originates in the House and then it goes over to the Senate, or does each chamber adopt its own resolution?
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I understand, according to Mr. Dewey, who I understand signed up to testify on the Senate side, that there is a Senate concurrent resolution on the Senate side, and he can give you more details as to what time it was heard and before what committee.
We'd like to have some history.
Mr. Chair, I am Mike Dewey. I have an interest in this bill. I would like to see you at some point in time sign a die. Albeit,
why weren't you here in April?
Albeit, I will say that the coordination between the Senate and the House is very good, in that today you have the same resolutions before you in the Senate Rules Committee and this committee. Now, I did not really sign up on the other side. Marlo Ray signed me up, and then I said I was not real interested in participating in that discussion. So some levity, I hope you do pass this particular measure, and it tells us something about getting out of here in early August.
Representative McPherson, you have any questions about leaving?
my only bone I would pick with this resolution, Vice Chair, is that it doesn't have a date specific, and I would have to amend it to for a day or two out.
I would suggest, Representative McPherson, if you give rule suspension, we can be out of here.
It would be my interest in doing so.
Okay. Any further discussion? Motion?
Mr. Chair, I move House Concurrent Resolution 18 to a floor with a pass-due pass.
Rose Boquist moves 8CR 18 to the floor with the due pass. Any further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Buzzard, excuse. Representative Boquist?
Yes.
Representative Flores?
She's excused. She'll be back in.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Chair Quigley?
Aye. HCR 18 moves the floor with the due pass, and I will carry it. Session, and we'll just be at ease here for just a moment. Open a work session at HCR 18 and ask for rule suspension so that Representative Flores can cast her vote. Any objections?
McPherson, if you object, you're dead.
we want to be walking hand in hand on this one.
I assume you're not objecting.
I'm not.
So Representative Flores, how do you vote?
Can I think about it?
Aye. Please note her vote. Close the work session on HCR 18. Open a work session on Senate Bill 1071A. Committee Administrator, what are we dealing with?
House Bill 1071A creates the Oregon Special School District within the Department of Education to provide online courses to K-12 public school students, allows the Superintendent of Public Instruction to contract with public entities to provide online courses which have met academic content standards as defined in statute and other criteria adopted by the State Board of Education, directs the Board to adopt rules for procedures and criteria for selecting the online courses to be offered and the qualifications of students who may access the courses, requires a public charter school that offers online courses to have 50% or more students reside in the school district wherein the charter school is located. Establishing the Oregon Virtual School District, it would create a fund of $2 million from the general fund. Attached to the staff measure summary is the vote from the Senate, the legislative revenue and fiscal statements, and the amendments that were submitted on our last meeting on 7/14.
Okay, and can you tell us the -6 amendments? That's the ones we're going to be dealing with.
-6 amendments would remove Section 5 of the bill, which relates to charter schools.
A motion on the bill?
Mr. Chair, I move the A6 into SB 1071A.
Mr. Goldquist, I move the A6 amendments into Senate Bill 1071A. Any discussion?
I do object to the A6s, Mr. Chair. My understanding was that this bill was to move in a clean form so that we could wrap up our business, and by doing that, we've got something that I think is not going to be concurred with on the other side, so I do object to that, and if we could learn a little bit about the A6s, and I think I could draw more information from folks who are here in attendance, if that would be useful input to the committee.
I think we need to move the bill. There's some what I call leadership direction.
Okay, very good. Then I just denote my objection.
Your objection is noted. Anything further? Sixes are in.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move SB 1071A as amended down to budget.
Okay, Representative Boquist has moved Senate Bill 1071A as amended to budget. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I will be a no on the bill because of the A6s, which I've convinced are troublesome enough that the merits of the bill, I think, are enough troublesome enough that I can't support it.
Okay, so noted. Call the roll, please.
Representative Barker, excuse. Representative Boquist?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
No.
Chair
Krieger? Aye. Senate Bill 1071A moves to budget. The due pass. I think that clears our agenda till maybe a little later this afternoon, depending on what gets assigned to us. So we'll close the committee until notice.
It's been resolved.
Federal Affairs, Tuesday, August 2nd, 4:45 p.m., open work session on Senate Bill 1074.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the A7 amendments into SB 1074.
Representative Boquist, I move the A7 amendments into Senate Bill 1074. Any objections? Hearing none, you're in.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move Senate Bill 1074 as amended to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Boquist has moved Senate Bill 1074 as amended to the floor with a due pass. Any conversation, objections, call the roll.
Representative Barker's excused. Representative Boquist?
Aye.
Representative Flores? Excuse. Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Aye. Senate Bill 1074A moves to the floor as amended with a due pass. Are you comfortable carrying this bill?
Sure. I think I understand it well enough to carry it.
Okay, thank you. We're adjourned. May of State and Federal Affairs to order Tuesday, August 2nd, 2005, about 6:25. We're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 1074 to get rid of the referral that was missed.
Mr. Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of considering a vote of SB 1074 Alpha.
Senator Boquist has moved that the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on Senate Bill 1074A. The motion is not debatable. Those of the opinion that the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on Senate Bill 1074A will say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, I move that we reconsider the vote by which 1074A was sent to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Representative Boquist moves that we reconsider the vote by which Senate Bill 1074A was sent to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation. Any committee discussion? Those of the opinion that we should reconsider the vote by which Senate Bill 1074 is sent to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation will say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, I move that the subsequent referral to Committee on Budget by prior reference be rescinded.
Representative Boquist moves that the subsequent referral to the Committee on the Budget by prior reference be rescinded. Any discussion? Those of the opinion that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Budget by prior reference be rescinded will say aye.
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 Those opposed? None. Motion carries.
Chair, I move that SB 1074A to the floor with a due pass as amended.
Representative Boquist, I move Senate Bill 1074A to the floor with a due pass as amended. Those of the opinion that we should send Senate Bill 1074A to the floor with a due passage amendment. We'll say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Motion carries. Terrible, you got to go through all that monkey business. You're the carrier again.
Aye. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Pleasure. Thank you very much. I didn't realize that I thought we were going to wait until we went on the floor for a bit.
Okay, we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 1041. We're going to have very little testimony. I'd like to have Senator Gordley come up for a moment, please.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I am Avel Gordley, Senate District 23, and with your permission, I'd like to bring up Sean Cruz, my legislative aide, who will assist me in briefly putting on to record why this the public policy embedded in Senate Bill 1041 is important. Just to share with you that President Courtney did appoint a interim task force on parental and family abductions. This task force had the task of reviewing the current state of Oregon law as it relates to the serious problem of parents abducting their own children in order to negate the lawful orders of Oregon courts regarding child custody and parental visitation rights. The findings of the task force were sent to all of your offices around the beginning of the session. Just to recall, the members of the task force included Carolina Caballero, who is with the Department of Human Services Child Welfare Department, Patrick Callahan, Senior Deputy DA in Multnomah County, Ms. Hart Haviv, Director of Tate Root, which is a Department of Justice-funded program that focuses on missing and exploited children, Judy Hayes with the Oregon State Police Missing Children Clearinghouse, Sybil Hebb, who is present, who is with the Oregon Law Center, Mickey Lansing with the State Commission on Children and Families, Judge Maureen McKnight from Multnomah County, John Menace, Director of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, Madeline Olson from the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services, Renelle Schenkel from the Attorney General's Office, Belisa Sidlick from the Family Law Senior Policy Program with the Oregon Judicial Department, and Denise Washington, who is Executive Director of the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. And the committee, the task force, was co-chaired by Senator Frank Morse and myself. As a result of the work of the task force, several things are happening. We know that those responsible for tracking missing children have developed a more efficient process for doing so. We also know that the Oregon State Bar, together with the State Court Administrator's Office, are working on training for members of the bar and judicial members so they gain a better understanding of child custody, parental abduction, parental visitation rights issues, a whole host of issues. And with that said, I would just like to defer to my legislative aide, Sean Cruz, his personal experience as a victim of abduction, having his children abduction, informs this body of work, and he will speak briefly about what the bill provides for.
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, my name is Sean Cruz, for the record, Senator Gordley's legislative aide, father of four children who were abducted from the state 9.5 years ago. I've been trying to recover them ever since. I am can't tell you how grateful I am that you're hearing this bill. I know you understand that. That Senate Bill 1041 creates a civil action for the crime of child abduction in the first degree if the child has been removed from the state. Custodial interference, one, to reach that threshold, you have to remove the child from the state. And so since the child is removed from the state, the statute of limitations doesn't apply as long as the child remains out of the state. Because the location of the abducted child victim and the abductor is typically not known, filing civil action against a culpable third party, as provided in the bill, may serve as a lever to accelerate the recovery of the abducted child. The President's task force agreed that the first priority following an abduction should be the safe and immediate return of the child. Many child abductions involve third parties who are criminally culpable and who may have knowledge of where the missing child is located. One reason that this bill focuses on immediate recovery is that parental abduction cases historically have not been a high priority for law enforcement. Victims encounter attitudes based on incorrect assumptions, most often that if a child is with a parent or family member, no real emergency exists. As a result, law enforcement is often slow to act, and which provides the abductor a lot more time with your child. This class of victims was falling through the cracks at many points in the enforcement of existing law in Oregon and across the nation. The President's task force also concluded that parental abduction has immediate, severe, and potentially unrecoverable consequences for the victims, and that a statewide campaign to educate judges, attorneys, and the general public is necessary. As a result, the Oregon State Bar is coordinating the fast-track education of practicing attorneys, and child abuse and mental health licensing boards are working similarly in their respective fields. The President's task force also studied the effects of abduction on the children. Because they are most likely to be abducted by persons known to them or related to them, abductions under these circumstances are a form of child abuse as devastating to the victim as any other form of abuse. We regard the breakup of families as tragedies. We know that children suffer when their families break up. They have typically lost, all at once, a parent, that parent's extended family, their home with that parent, all of their friends and classmates, their school, their neighborhood, their church, and all that is familiar to them. Oftentimes, in even their own names, and they may be forced to dress as the opposite sex. Child victims live lives on the run. They lose access to health care and education. An abductor is not likely to take the child to a doctor as swiftly as someone else might, because that's taking the child to a reporting authority. As a consequence, they don't get the treatment. My son Aaron, who I buried 3 months ago, had both of his upper arms were covered with the scars of self-inflicted knife wounds that were never treated, and there were 15 of those, huge scars. I have no idea when those scars were made, other than they started sometime within a year after the abduction. The work group we worked through 10 amendments to get to where we built in protections for cases where the person taking the child is fleeing from a domestic violence situation, or there's harm, threat of harm involved. We did that, and with that, I'll conclude my testimony.
I would just conclude, Mr. Chairman, to say that in 2003, the U.S. Department of Justice issued a report estimating that the number of parental and family abductions exceeds 200,000 children per year. We're very grateful to President Courtney for having appointed the task force. We commend the task force report to you, and we thank you sincerely for hearing the bill this evening.
Okay. May members have any questions? Ms. Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Either Mr. Cruz or Senator Gordley. Now, the trigger here is if the child is taken out of state, and is that it is regardless of whether they go out of state to another state or out of state into another country, for instance, Canada or Mexico. So it would still be that's the trigger, that they've just left the state?
Chair Krieger, Representative Flores, yes. Custodial interference in the first degree requires the defendant to violate custodial interference in the second degree, which means knowing the person has no right to do so. They entice, they keep, or they take or they keep a child from its lawful custodian. that's custodial two. To take it to the level of one, they have to take the child out of state or expose that child to harm.
Ms. McPherson, do you have anything?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move Senate Bill 1041 Alpha to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Boquist has moved Senate Bill 1041A to the floor with a due pass. Any discussion? Objections? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barker's excused. Representative Boquist?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Chair Krager?
Aye. Senate Bill 1041A moves the floor with a due pass. Representative Flores can carry. Senator Gorley, do you have any more of these you're going to bring my way?
We're still here, Mr. Chair. You know. I do want to say for the record again, a most sincere thank you to all of you. Thank you, Representative Flores, for being willing to carry this measure. And I also want to acknowledge Bill Taylor, because he served as committee administrator for the Parental Abduction Task Force and made a great contribution to the work of that body. Again, thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, I would just comment to the Senator and to Mr. Cruz. This is dear to my heart. I have two grandchildren who have been taken from their father, and they're somewhere in Mexico.
Mm.
So this won't help me, but I'm delighted to be able to carry the bill.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Okay. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 228A. Staff will tell us a little bit about the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 228A establishes a minimum amount of participation in physical education, aka PE, for K-8 public school and public charter school students. It establishes that kindergarten through fifth grade are required to participate in 150 minutes each school week, and 6 through 8 grades are required to participate in 225 minutes each school week. It also specifies that the PE requirements for the PE instructions in the bill becomes operative in July 1 of 2017. It also establishes a physical education fund in the Department of Education for a grant program that school districts and charter schools can apply to for to fulfill the PE instruction requirement. It also directs the Department of Ed to convene an advisory committee during the 2005-2007 biennium to report back, well, to develop rules and criteria and report back to the legislature on the grant program.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Dewey, can you come up just a moment, please? This wasn't yours. Who was it? Excuse me, Donovan. That's close.
That's even worse, Mr. Chair.
I guess when you got two people harassing you constantly for hearings, you get mixed up who's harassing you.
Just make sure Mr. Donovan doesn't have a heart attack in front of us.
Thank you.
He's a good physical specimen, so.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for bringing this legislation forward. My name is Phil Donovan. I'm here on behalf of the American Heart Association, and what you have before you today represents over a year and a half of research, coalition building, and compromise to bring forward very thoughtful and responsible legislation for you. Senate Bill 228 represents an effort of collaboration among healthcare and education advocates to address Oregon's childhood obesity problem. In Oregon, over 23% of eighth graders are overweight. Over the past two decades, we've seen with teenagers a tripling of obesity rates. Our vision is to deliver quality physical education to students and assure schools the resources to meet these standards. That's why we amended the bill to develop a competitive grant process to meet the physical education instruction requirements by 2017. Our vision is over the next decade to provide the resources and to clear the hurdles that limit the ability to provide physical education physical education like that that we experienced as youth growing up. The legislation will also importantly provide the 2007 legislative session with a report on what PE is being delivered. Given the small fiscal impact and the spirit of efficiency, we hope that we'll be able to rescind the budget referral. And with that, I would close and just give a quick moment to my colleague, Julie Brim Edwards, who works with Nike and has been an important part of our coalition building that was described in the newspapers as gone from a small grassroots band to a blue ribbon coalition of support.
Thanks. I'm Julia Brim Edwards with Nike, and I'm also a parent of three young children and once was a aspiring PE teacher, but I got into politics instead. Nike is part of the coalition in support of this bill. If trends continue, today's kids are going to be the first generation of children who will have a shorter lifespan than their parents. There is a growing obesity epidemic in this country. We see this as one way to address that, getting kids more physically active. We currently have a program called PE to Go that we try and bring PE back into schools that have lost it for a variety of reasons. But we look at this approach as something that could have an impact on kids across the state. And as a parent, when I look at my kids, it will be good for them and their colleagues in schools because PE is one of the few times that kids might have an opportunity to be active during the school day. So we're wholeheartedly in support of the bill, and we've got a broad coalition that's supporting it.
Okay. Committee members, do you have any questions? I guess you're free to go, and we'll hear from Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Good evening, Mr. Chair. For the record, State Representative Jerry Crummell, House District 26, Wilsonville, Sherwood, and over to Gaston. Senate Bill 228, you already know the particulars of it, so I won't sit here and try to restate all of those sorts of things. It really establishes a minimum amount of participation in physical education, and my background is so I know a little bit about physical education. I hold a Master of Arts in Teaching in Physical Education from Lewis and Clark and a Bachelor of Science in Physical Education from the University of Utah. So I've been around this field for a long, long time. I wish that the bill took effect immediately. I think that quite frankly, what we need to do is get kids off their butts and outside playing and in a gym and other ways of moving around. We had a bill earlier this session that would have had a health commission study on reduction of obesity in our children, and I just told you some of what my feelings are as far as how we reduce obesity in children. Also get rid of the ding-dongs, but that's beside the point. But the human body is meant to move and be active, and some would argue that PE is just going outside or in a gym playing games, but I can assure you that nothing is further from the truth. We had opening ceremonies in the House earlier this session with a physical educator who took us through some paces, and I think what did we learn from the experience was, besides how many of us are movement challenged, is that we learned that it's more than just games, and you learn how to move in an efficient manner, and you learn how to balance, and you learn how to get your heart rate up and what it means in cardiovascular conditioning. We can learn about developing strength and muscular endurance, and in physical education, students also learn more about sportsmanship, healthy lifestyles, and lifelong activities that can be fun, and energizing at the same time. You know that I insist a lot on performance measures, and one of the things that probably makes me such an advocate of performance measures is my background as a physical educator. You see, in physical education, it is the one subject that having actual performance measures are based on objective criteria, not what somebody else thinks the students did. The student starts with a pretest to see where they are in relation to their fitness standards, and then they are post-tested to see what gains they have made from the activities they've participated in. They're not measured against each other, but they're measured against themselves. I won't go on, Mr. Chair, unless you would like me to, but those are some of the things that I think are important about this bill, is getting kids moving and teaching them how to move. And like I said, I would prefer that the bill had an immediate start date. I would also prefer that it went K-12 instead of K-8. I think by leaving out the high schools, we're making a mistake, but maybe that's something that we can come back next session and insert if this bill passes. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Committee members, any questions?
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you. I just wondered, the reference that Representative Crummell had to ding-dongs, was that the consumable kind or the walking around kind?
Well, you know, really both, but in this particular presentation, I was talking about the chocolate-covered ones that are edible and preserve you forever.
Thank you.
Actually, I do have a question, Mr. Chair. Representative Crummell, this is just a question about the mechanics of the sort of timing of the bill. I mean, it looks to me like the 0507 biennium is devoted to gathering information, and then starting in the 0709 biennium, there are grants made to enable districts to comply with the requirements of Section 2, which are the substantive requirements about the amount, but those requirements don't actually kick in until 2017. So is the idea that it's sort of a warm-up period, that, or maybe this is with Mr. Donovan?
Let me go ahead and defer to Mr. Donovan on that, because I'm not sure exactly what the Senate's thinking was as far as the timing on this, and that's why I say I would prefer to see school districts move immediately into it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pearson, Phil Donovan on behalf of the American Heart Association. The vision for the legislation, as you refer to as the timing, is that we would use the 0507 biennium to essentially build a competitive grant program. And going into what a competitive grant program would look like, if two schools have a good idea that they want to increase the physical education standards, but we only have X amount of resources, we have to figure out what the weighting is. How are we going to decide, if we have limited resources, which school or school district would be funded first? Now, we also have to consider what the funding sources might be for a grant program, because I don't want to simply presume that it would just be state dollars. It could be federal dollars. It could be lottery dollars. It could be public as well as private dollars. Those are the issues that need to be considered over this biennium. And then the vision, as I mentioned earlier, is for 20% implementation over the next 10 years to get us to 100% implementation by 2017. I hope that helps you to understand what we hope to bring back in 07 and further define for you.
Okay. Follow-up question, if I could. But where do the dollars come from that are going into the fund?
Chair Krieger, Representative McPherson, we do not presume to know what those funds will be. That's what we would use the upcoming biennium to define. I would comment also that we do not envision this being a part of the school funding formula, but rather to be outside of that.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. I'm ready for a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move SB 228A to budget.
Representative West, I move Senate Bill 228 to budget. Any discussion, objections?
A quick comment, Mr. Chair. I'm a yes vote, but I'm a little concerned that it's an unfunded mandate. But I guess at 2017, they can work on it downstairs.
That's probably what they're doing that for. Call the roll, please.
Representative Boquist?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Chair Craver?
Aye. Senate Bill 228 moves to the Budget Committee with a due pass recommendation. Close the work session on that. Open the work session on Senate Bill 648.
Senate Bill 648. Mr.
Chair, members. Senate Bill 648 requires a person who is applying for, renewing,
or replacing or reinstating a driver's license permit or identification card to provide two forms of biometric data or to verify against biometric data in the records of the Department of Transportation. The bill defines biometric data as described in the staff measure summary. It also allows the department to charge, and I'm sorry, this is a typo, it allows the department to charge up to $2 to $3 for a license permit or renewal for the cover to cause cover the costs. And according along with that, you'll find a fiscal analysis attached to the staff measure summary, and there's also testimony in your packet from Andrea Meyer of ACLU. Available to answer any questions, we have Mike Dewey, who can answer technical questions on the system itself. We have the Department of Transportation available to answer questions on implementation.
Mr. Dewey, just a moment, please. Give us your minute and a half best sales job.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Mike Dewey, recommending representing Digimark. Digimark is an Oregon company. They operate in 33 states, including Oregon, providing driver's license services. This bill came out of the Senate 28-2. There were a Republican and a Democrat voting no, so that's good bipartisan opposition. The Marion County Sheriff, Sheriff Ramirez, if he was here, would provide eloquent testimony to you why this bill is needed. The bill is supported by DMV, the Bankers Association, and the Credit Union Association. The bill is not envisioned, but will prevent some ID theft, fraud, and to a degree we can talk about this as a tourism tool. Your staff talked about two forms of biometrics. There is actually...
We've got a call, and so we're going to recess for a few minutes, and we'll come back. And
thank you for your
time. Sorry. Convene the House Committee on State and Federal Affairs, and... Mr. Dewey, I'm going to try to ask you to finish up rather quickly. They're going to need us back on the floor, so we have to go back and forth for calls of the House. And we're on Senate Bill 640. Resume our work session.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, again, Mike Dewey, representing Digimark, an Oregon company. Senate Bill 640, as you know, has a referral also to the Budget Committee. This particular bill has two security features that would go into effect July 1 of 2008. This allows the Department of Motor Vehicles to work with the various players to develop the two features, and let me go through those very quickly. One is facial recognition, and that's the only biometric, and it's defined. At one point in the bill on the Senate side, there was fingerprinting, and that was deleted from the bill. And basically what that does, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, is allow the department to find out if there are individuals that have more than one picture in the system under different names. And unfortunately, there are a number of people in Oregon that have driver's licenses or a number of driver's licenses with the same picture with different names. A number of states have moved in this direction, at least a dozen. Contracts are being bid in other states. This is a proven system. The other is central issuance. What that means is you would get, when this bill goes into effect, rather than getting your driver's license over the counter, because of the security feature and because of the Real ID Act, you'd get your license mailed to you in a couple days so that the authenticity of that individual can be verified on the front end and to determine whether or not they have additional photos in the system. So I would say in finishing that Colorado has this, and it's been very successful. So, Mr. Chair, hopefully I've been brief enough for you on this particular bill.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Dewey, I'm a little at sea with this bill. What I'm seeing is that we're going to require every person who gets a driver's license to submit to a biometric scan, I guess you might call it, to get them into a database, and we're going to charge them up to $3 every time that they get a renewal. And what I want to know is what are we getting for that? That's a major fee increase for all Oregonians, and how does this improve their lives?
Mr. Chair and Representative Pearson, we had looked at a number of different biometrics. And basically what we're trying to do is prevent a number of things. When it's all said and done, what we're trying to do is prevent somebody coming into the system and trying to get a driver's license with their photo under another name. And biometrics and facial recognition allows the department to determine whether or not, for example, and the good sheriff from Marion County was able to show the committee on the Senate side, and Senator Winters showed these placards of individuals that have, once they were arrested, they found out that they had five or six different photos under different names. And quite frankly, as the sheriff said, a lot of this was tied to meth. And so it's identity theft on one hand, it's illegal activity on the drug production on the other side. Again, a number of states are moving in this direction, so this is not something that is new to Oregon by any means. Colorado has it, Oklahoma has it, it's being bid right now in Texas and Virginia. So I do think it does improve people's lives.
Oh, if I could, I guess I may want to probe that a little bit. So we have this database of scans of each individual who comes in and gets a driver's license. How is that data used? You mentioned meth, you mentioned identity theft.
Mm-hmm.
How does somebody access that database? How does that actually help law enforcement do things it need doing?
All right. Mr. Chair and Representative McPherson, let's go back to basically how it works. You come in, you're having your picture taken. If you've come in and this is a renewal, the individual would be able to, because you already have your photo digitized in the system, that individual, as I understand it, who works at DMV behind the counter, would be able to determine right then and there if that picture in the system corresponds with you. Okay, that's number one, a positive. Now, there will be people that will come in, and they will have a name, a different face than the picture in the system. Obviously, there's a red flag. What happens with the facial recognition is now you have an opportunity, in the software package, and DMV would decide this, as to what kind of a match you would want to do in terms of individuals in the system that would potentially look like you. And the match could be a 10-to-1, it could be a 5-to-1, depending on the rule that's promulgated or how DMV wants to do it. So an individual is then going to look at your picture with a number of other pictures that come up to see whether or not there's a match.
So if I could break in maybe at that point. So the function of it, or the purpose of it, is to prevent issuing multiple licenses to one individual who has the same facial characteristics, so they can't get a license issued as John Jones and as Richard Rowe and as, you know, Clem Cadiddlehopper.
That is the purpose, yes.
Okay. And there was something I saw in the material I was given about the declining accuracy as people as passage of time. And I think that I figured that it was a 5% error rate per year in sort of the accuracy of the scan.
Mr. Chair and Representative McPherson, I think you're referring to a 2002 study. If I'm looking now, we can read in a number of things into the study I can quote here. Part of this is the difference between a controlled environment and a non-controlled or outdoor environment. And I say that because with regard to the surveillance of someone, you're going to have a whole different verification rate. But in the information that I have, it says, for example, for the best systems, verification performance drops from 95% to 54% going from indoors to outdoors. Again, Mr. Chair and Representative McPherson, this does not go into effect until October 1 of 2008. The technology is getting better all the time, and other states are using it, and they find that it works extremely well. And if you will, the Motor Carrier Association has endorsed this. And I think if anybody is an expert in this arena, I have some quotes. I didn't want to get into that because of the time. From an ID newswire that gets into this, and in their last edition, they talked about biometrics and the effectiveness of this particular program.
Okay.
It is not 100%.
Okay. Mr. Chair, but I think one more question. I think we're probably the last one. What safeguards will DMV have available to prevent hacking and stealing of biometric information?
Mr. Chair and Representative Pearson, the department is here and they can speak to that. I guess I'm puzzled by why anybody would want to hack in and steal somebody's biometrical features or their facial recognition. To what end that would do, I can't fathom. If somebody wanted to hack into their photo, or if you had fingerprinting, I could understand that. But we already have photos in the system today, so we're not changing anything. But to hack in and utilize in some mysterious and mischievous way the biometric cures, facial recognition, I can understand fingerprints, but how you would use that, I can't comprehend in some fraudulent ID theft way. You'd perhaps hack in and get the photo. I'm sure they have safeguards, but like every system, there are problems if we assume a security breach.
Okay, that's all I had for this witness, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for your
question.
Question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for indulging me in one last question. Mr. Dewey, the ACLU letter here in the first paragraph indicates that this relies on software that's unlikely to work in Oregon because we only take new driver's license photos once every 8 years. Can you give us your position in light of that statement?
Mr. Chair and Representative Flores, I think what they're talking about is you know, over time there's the degradation, and I would submit that there's going to be some degradation. The information I have seen is the, with regard to the biometrics, as you get older, it is much more reliable. At least that's what the study shows. 8 years, now it may be that at some point in time we may want to go to 4 years. I mean, we may choose to do that, depending on what happens in the system. But, and I'm not an expert on this, but there are formulas, if you will, mathematical formulas that take into consideration certain aspects of the face. And quite frankly, what could happen, and we talked about this, is Mike Dewey comes in, they do the facial recognition, they take it with some other individuals, and a woman may show up, for example. And I mean, clearly, okay, that's not, you know, there's not a match here. Again, there's going to be some degradation in the system. There is no question about that. It's not going to be 100%. The question is, do we want to move in a way that, if you will, makes the system better and more reliable? And that's the trade-off. I don't see any inconvenience here. The people that have been matched, as I understand it, that have more than one face in the system or photo, they're going to receive a letter from DMV saying, would you please come in? I suspect they're probably not going to come in. But you've got now a red flag, you know, what's going on with this particular person. So it's not 100% accurate, but again, this does not go into effect until 2008. So the software changes.
We're under a call again. We can continue this, or we can make a motion.
Mr. Chair, here's my perspective on it, and we can wrap this up very quickly. I think if we're going to vote on it now, I'd register a no vote, really as a matter of caution about this bill. I have some concerns about the civil liberties perspectives. I'm more concerned about the fundamental question of whether that technology is good enough to justify having every Oregonian who gets a driver's license have to pay $3 to get the scan.
So we're going to have to go to these, go to the floor, and come back. Okay. He's standing in the hallway.
Okay,
thank you. He's in the hallway. I'd be happy to stay again. Reconvene the State and Federal Affairs and continue the open work session on Senate Bill 640. Representative McPherson, you were explaining yourself.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, at this point, you know, we're end of session, new issues coming at me. I've learned everything I know about this subject. I've just learned in the last few minutes. At this point, I'm unconvinced as yet, could be convinced that the technology is of sufficient quality and will have enough positive effect to justify that kind of fee. But I think at this point, if we're going to bring it to a vote, as we probably need to do, I'll register a no just as a concern. But I'll get input from the folks who are advocating for it and would like to hear from law enforcement as well, if there's anybody around paying attention, and then maybe vote for it on the floor.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move SB 640A to the Budget Committee.
Representative Volquist has moved 640A to the Budget Committee. Any objections, discussion? Make sure we have got Representative McPherson's consideration. That's registered. Clerk, want to call the roll, please?
Representative Volquist?
Yes.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
No.
Chair Krieger?
Aye. Senate Bill 640 moves to the Budget Committee with a due pass recommendation. Close the work session on 640. Close the hearing, and I don't believe we're going to be scheduled till sometime in the morning if we see if any bills are delivered to through leadership to this committee.
After 9?
Yes. It'll be after 9.
After 9. After 9.